The following Bible study is presented by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Greetings, and thank you for joining us for another series of Bible studies where we will dive deep into the book of the prophet Amos. And so without ado, let's open up the book and turn over to the first chapter. Amos in chapter 1. The name Amos is sometimes pronounced Amos. It derives from the Hebrew amas, meaning to carry a load or impose a burden. Amos, therefore, means burdensome. His message was definitely hard for some to hear, and it would be a hard fulfillment of prophecy for many to bear. It's interesting how the prophets were given names from birth that would coincide with the most important work they would do, that is, being a prophet sent by God. It brings to mind God's words to Jeremiah, saying that he was destined to be called from the moment of his conception. And this further indicates God's wisdom, and that he knows the direction nations will take when they refuse to apply his moral laws. Amos begins his writing with a short introduction of himself in Amos 1 and verse 1. The words of Amos, who was among the sheep breeders of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. It seems that Amos wanted to make several things clear before he got into the profound details of his prophecies. He mentions his name, profession, location, the subject matter of the preceding text, who the kings of Israel and Judah were, being a divided kingdom at that time, also noting that this message occurred 2 years before an infamous regional event setting a near exact time of when the prophecies occurred, or at least when they were given. All of these are important pieces of information before proceeding to consider what God had to say through this prophet. Something that was first noted was the fact that God and Amos wanted it to be known that this man had religious or political training. This wasn't in any state-sponsored organization. It could be that the point was made so that nobody would think that he was a part of a system that had become vastly corrupt. The corruption would have included some who would attempt to appear righteous, but would have been considered false prophets by faithful people. The reason being, they were a part of that corrupt system. The prophecies of Amos, however, were given during the reigns of King Uzziah over Judah in the south and King Jeroboam II over Israel in the north. This was about 200 years after Israel had split and the northern kingdom set up a state-sponsored idolatry in Bethel and Dan. Then this was an attempt to keep people of the northern tribes from going to Jerusalem 3 times a year for the pilgrimage feasts. Some of that information can be found in 1 Kings in chapter 12. The prophets Elijah, Elisha, and Jonah had already done their part. Isaiah was a contemporary at this time of Amos, and God called Amos, whose ministry was approximately 30 years before the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians. Hosea was another prophet that God would utilize during this same time period, and it's believed that Joel also prophesied during the final years before the house of Israel was conquered. Amos prophesied during a time when the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, had increased its borders and the economy was getting better. God is the one who allowed this to happen, but it wasn't because the administration was turning away from evil. The gains made were the result of God having sympathy for the people who were suffering greatly. Some of that is noted in 2 Kings chapter 14. Things appeared to be looking up, but there continued to be widespread injustice and idolatry. All that we can know about the prophet Amos is found in his book, his writings. He says that he was among those who were sheep breeders, which is also translated as herdsmen and sheep masters. It appears to indicate a rancher instead of a shepherd who took care of a flock of sheep. The location of Amos' trade was Tekoa, about 10 miles south of Jerusalem. In chapter 7 of his book, in verse 14, it states that Amos was also a gatherer of sycamore fruit, which is likened to figs on the inside, but very different on the outside. Amos said that the following words are what he saw at the time of his calling. Most of what follows is not a vision, but the majority are words. Nonetheless, the expression that he used means that these things were caused by God, things that God had caused Amos to know. God gave him a message that opened the eyes of his mind, if you will. It's like one of us being told something that we would respond to with, "Oh, I see," meaning we understand, we heard it, we understood it. I think they both apply in the case with Amos, though, that he did have some kind of a vision as well as hearing these words. If you have a ribbon, go ahead and put a bookmark here in Amos chapter 1, and we're going to go over to 2 Chronicles chapter 26 for just a moment. The prophet also said that his calling for this purpose happened 2 years before the earthquake. That statement indicates that documenting his ministry must have occurred 2 or more years later. In addition, the earthquake mentioned was severe enough to make note of it on more than one occasion in the Bible, and it's not by this prophet alone. This same quake is referenced more than 2 centuries later by the prophet Zechariah, who spoke of Christ's return when he will step down on Mount Olivet, splitting the mountain in two from the east into the west. Now, Zechariah had said that the people in the area at that time shall flee through the mountain valley as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. That's in Zechariah 14 and verse 5. The earthquake of comparison was significant enough for this example to be made of a future ground-splitting seismic event when Christ returns. But exactly when did the previous quake occur, the one that Amos referred to, as well as Zechariah? Well, Uzziah's reign over the southern kingdom of Judah began at the young age of 16. Uzziah ruled between 790 and 739 BC. He was a good king for many years and served God and the people well. Eventually, the great success that he had went to his head and his ego, and Uzziah became proud and arrogant. A significant presumptuous sin turned the tables for him, and this is documented in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. And we're going to begin reading in verse 16, where it says, "But when he was strong," speaking of Uzziah, "his heart was lifted up to his destruction, for he transgressed against the Eternal, his God, by entering the temple of the Eternal to burn incense on the altar of incense," something that only the priests were to do. "So Azariah the priest went in after him, and with him were 80 priests of the Eternal, valiant men. And they withstood King Uzziah and said to him, 'It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Eternal, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have trespassed. You shall have no honor from the Eternal God.' Then Uzziah became furious with these words, and he had a censer in his hand to burn incense. And while he was angry with the priests, leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Eternal, beside the incense of altar. And Azariah the chief priest and all the priests looked at him, and there on his forehead he was leprous. So they thrust him out of that place. Indeed, he also hurried to get out because the Eternal had struck him." So no leprous person would have been allowed in the temple. That was one of God's rules. This is basically saying, not just a curse, but saying, get out. Uzziah was being presumptuous. King Uzziah was a leper until the day of his death, as it says in verse 21. He dwelt in an isolated house because he was a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Eternal. Then Jotham, his son, was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. Now the rest of the acts of Uzziah, from first to last, the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amos, wrote. So Uzziah rested with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the field of burial which belonged to the kings, for they said, "He is a leper." Then Jotham, his son, reigned in his place. Another document of Uzziah's sin was recorded by the Jewish general Josephus, and you'll see why I read this account right here in just a moment. Josephus may have lived centuries after the event that we had just read of, but this man's knowledge of history has been considered a credible witness of ancient activity by most scholars and historians. Josephus also mentioned the great earthquake, but his account attributes the earthquake to Uzziah's presumptuous sin. Notice what it says here in Antiquities of the Jews, Book 9, Chapter 10 and Verse 4. Uzziah was corrupted in his mind by pride and became insolent. And I'm skipping a few verses in between here. When a remarkable day was come and a general festival was to be celebrated, he put on the holy garment and went into the temple to offer incense to God upon the golden altar, which he was prohibited to do by Azariah the high priest, who had 80 priests with him, and who told him that it was not lawful for him to offer sacrifice, and that none besides the posterity of Aaron were permitted so to do. And when they cried out that he must go out of the temple and not transgress against God, he was wroth at them and threatened to kill them unless they would hold their peace. In the meantime, a great earthquake shook the ground and rent was made in the temple. And bright rays of the sun shone through it and fell upon the king's face, insomuch that the leprosy seized upon him immediately. And before the city, at the place called Arog, half the mountain broke off from the rest of the west and rolled itself 4 furlongs, which is approximately 1/2 mile, and stood still at the east mountain till the roads as well as the king's gardens were spoiled by the obstruction. So you see, this was quite an earthquake that caused this part of a mountain to be moved 1/2 mile. The Book of Chronicles did not say that the earthquake coincided with the onset of leprosy for King Uzziah, and therefore we cannot be sure that the events actually coincided. However, the earthquake did occur during the reign of King Uzziah, and it can be known also from geological and archaeological sources that such a quake did in fact occur. There is a record of this great earthquake dating back to the mid-8th century BC. Evidence had been found in an archaeological dig during the 1950s at a destruction layer at Hazor. And also, in recent years in Jerusalem, on a major fault line, evidence was found in the Dead Sea. According to an article by Stephen Austin at the International Creation Research, he wrote, "The city of Gezer was also severely shaken. The outer wall of the city shows hewn stones weighing tons that have been cracked and displaced several inches off their foundation. The lower part of the wall was displaced outward, that is, away from the city, whereas the upper part of the wall fell inward, toward the city, still lying course on course. This indicates that the wall collapsed suddenly." In addition to this, sudden destruction levels from the same time can also be found at Lachish, at a place called Acre, at Tel Dan, Tel Abu Huam, Deir Allah, Tel Judea, and Ian Hesavia in a tightly confined stratigraphy of the 8th century BC. Tel Shafi, which is the Philistine Gath, had a 13-foot thick wall that fell on its side in the same period. "That damage couldn't have been made," said Amos Agnon of the Institution of Earth Sciences, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. "That damage couldn't have been man-made," said Amos Agnon of the Institute of Earth Sciences in Jerusalem at the Hebrew University. Scientific technology has advanced with the ability to study core samples taken at the Dead Sea, examining what's called varves. A varve is an annual layer of sediment or sedimentary rock. The Department of Geophysics and Planetary Sciences of Tel Aviv University presented findings of their study of the layers of sediment laying on top of a fault line near En Gedi. The results are startling. Clear signs of a major seismic activity, an event somewhere around 750 BC, they say. And they estimate that the quake had a magnitude of well over 7.0 and likely as high as 8.2. It's the largest known earthquake to have occurred in this region for thousands of years. In August of 2021, more evidence was uncovered in Jerusalem in the city of David when a destruction layer dating to that same time period that Amos wrote about. It revealed a row of shattered vessels, including bowls, lamps, cooking utensils, and storage jars, and they were smashed as the building's walls collapsed. And I have a short video about this that we can watch, but I won't show that to you now. The earthquake that Amos wrote about and others wrote about certainly did occur if we go back to Amos in chapter 1. After indicating the timing of what he saw, Amos moves right into the prophecies, beginning with describing the kind of attention that this message he had to deliver deserves. In Amos 1 and verse 2, "And he said, the Eternal roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. The pastures of the shepherds mourn and the top of Carmel withers." This is talking about a lush place. Carmel is a lush place that means it's fading. And roaring from Zion mean this is where the temple was established, his voice uttering from Jerusalem. Comparing the action that God would take with the roar of a lion is a striking illustration. A lion roars as a warning that there is potential of something dreadful about to occur if the roar was not heeded. Many of us today are somewhat desensitized to this kind of illustration because we may have seen it depicted dozens of times in the movies, or maybe we've been to the circus and seen it happen. MGM began their films for a long time with the lion roaring, and occasionally they still use that logo today. Hosea, Joel, and Christ used the same imagery, saying that the Lord will roar. What this portrays is striking the people with fear because of the power that God has to establish or to destroy. And when the strength becomes evident, it's a warning to all, just as the roar of a lion tells those in the vicinity to stand on proper ground if you want to be spared. The mourning of shepherds that is mentioned portrays the fact that the leaders will mourn because their flocks will be tragically impacted. Carmel was a very fruitful area, and it's portrayed as withering because of removing God's protection and blessing. The roar from Zion and Jerusalem is because that's where his temple was established, and those locations portray Jerusalem above, the heavenly Mount Zion. And there is a reality represented by these corporeal places. A temple on the earth fashioned after God's throne in heaven, for example. Amos was called to chastise Israel and Judah for their iniquity. The iniquity was the reason for God removing his protection from these people. However, God did not inspire what would be cruel and brutal treatment from the surrounding nations of Israel and Judah. Invasion and destruction of those people was allowed, but the unnecessary tactics of war that were shocking and horrifying were still abhorrent to God, and he would not let such behavior pass without consequence. Therefore, the reprimand moves quickly to a prophecy against Gentile nations, starting with Syria. In Amos 1 and verse 3, "Thus says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Damascus, and for four I will not turn away its punishment, because they have threshed Gilead with implements of iron." For three transgressions and for four is an idiomatic phrase. Together they make seven, which is a number representing completion. But it does not mean that there were only 3, 4, or 7 transgressions. It means that there were more than enough to justify what God would do. Damascus was the capital of Syria in ancient times, and it continues to be that area's capital to this day, indicating that the people, these are the people that God was speaking of. Again, keep a bookmark here, and let's turn over to 2 Kings 13 for a moment. The invasion of the Syrians is well documented. The book of Kings speaks of this tragic part of Israel's history. In 2 Kings, let's go to chapter 10 first. Chapter 10 and verse 31. Where it says, "But Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the eternal God of Israel with all his heart, for he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, who made Israel sin. In those days, the Eternal began to cut off parts of Israel, and Hazael conquered them in all the territory of Israel, from the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, including Gilead and Bashan." And then if you go to chapter 13 and verse 1, it says, "In the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 17 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. He did not depart from them. Then the anger of the Eternal was aroused against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, all their days. So Jehoahaz pleaded with the Eternal, and the Eternal listened to him, for he saw the oppression of Israel, because the king of Syria oppressed them." In other words, he allowed these people to come in and to do damage, to conquer them to a degree, but he did not agree with the cruel behavior. "And then the Eternal gave Israel a deliverer so that they escaped from under the hand of the Syrians, and the children of Israel dwelt in their tents as before. Nevertheless, they did not depart from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, who had made Israel sin, but walked in them, and the wooden image also remained in Samaria. For he left the army of Jehoahaz only 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers, for the king of Syria had destroyed them and made them like the dust at threshing." Some depictions in the Bible are poetic or allegoric, such as a lion roaring. However, the depiction of threshing grain and creating much dust on the ground is not only illustrative, It's believed that something like this did actually occur. Commentator Albert Barnes says this about the event in these scriptures: "Like the dust by threshing, an expression not only employed metaphorically and importing defeat, conquest, and grinding oppression, but implying also the literal use of threshing instruments in the execution of prisoners of war." Jamieson, Fawcett, and Brown wrote, "The figure originated in a barbarous war custom which Hazael, king of Syria at the time, literally followed. That was the implements of iron that Amos wrote about. The cruelty of the Syrians was perhaps only rivaled by the Assyrians, who would later be instrumental in entirely destroying Israel as a nation. However, again, the barbaric tactics of these people were not inspired by God. They were unnecessary, and they would not go unchecked." If you go back to Amos, chapter 1, what we see in the beginning of these Gentile prophecies in Amos, chapter 1, is that God does not show partiality when it comes to sin. He cares about everyone, even though some are the apple of his eye. If those who are called sin without repentance, he will punish those people. If those who are not called sin, they will be punished as well. Though God is responsible for bringing Syria into Israel as a means to punish the northern tribes, he did not inspire their idolatry or their brutality. He simply allowed them to invade. In verse 4 and verse 5, we'll read these two verses here. But I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. I will also break the gate bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitant from the valley of Avon and the one who holds the scepter from Beth-Eden. These people of Syria shall go captive to Kir, says the Eternal. Hazael was a Syrian king, as we had read previously in 2 Kings. And surprisingly, he was apparently anointed by Elijah to be king. He wasn't ordained as a servant of God, but only to be king of Syria. And that anointing is found in 1 Kings chapter 19. Ben-Hadad, that is mentioned here, was also a king of these people, and the term portrays the royal line of Syria and its palatial estates. Because their invasion included needless cruelty, Syria would face retribution for the merciless pain and suffering that they had caused. Some of the reprisal was documented in 2 Kings chapter 16. I'm going to go ahead and turn over there and read that. Chapter 16, verses 7 through 9. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and the gold that was found in the house of the Eternal and in the treasuries of the king's house and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it, carried its people captive to Kir, and killed Rezin. That's R-E-Z-I-N. I'm not sure if it's pronounced Rezin or Rezin. In any case, here we see a fulfillment of the prophecy. God declared that they would pay, and they did. He made it happen. And then in the next verses of Amos, chapter 1, God turned his judgment to the Philistines, who were also a cruel and wicked people. In Amos 1, verses 6 through 10, for three transgressions of Gaza, and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they took captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. But I will send a fire upon the wall of Gaza, which shall devour its palaces, and I will cut off the inhabitant from Ashdod and the one who holds the scepter from Ashkelon. I will turn my hand against Ekron, and the remnant of the Philistines shall perish, says the Eternal God. Gaza is a short strip of land, and it's a name from ancient times that has been retained. The name has been retained, that is, in the Middle East. It was a military stronghold that represented five Philistine cities. Three of them are mentioned, being Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Ekron. All of them had leaders, as this was a popular trade route. The captivity likely refers to the taking of the king of Judah's house when the Philistines and Arabians invaded and ransacked everything. They also took his children and his wives. Only one son of this king was left, and that's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 21 and verse 17. 2 Chronicles chapter 25 also documents Edom invading along with the Philistines. It appears that Israeli captives were given to a people who have a long history of hatred and ill will toward Israel. This is the infamous Edomites. Now we move to another people in verse 9. Thus says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Tyre, and for four I will not turn away its punishment, because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom, and did not remember the covenant of brotherhood. But I will send a fire upon the wall of Tyre, which shall devour its palaces. Tyre is a Phoenician city north of Palestine. It's an area that the prophet Ezekiel used to depict its king as the devil, and that's found in Ezekiel 28. At one time, Hiram, the king of Tyre, had respect and admiration for Israel. This is when King David and then King Solomon ruled. They had sent cedar trees, carpenters, and masons to build David a house. That's found in 1 Samuel 5 and 1 Kings 5. The two nations were kind to one another and showed their hospitality by an exchange of goods and services. That is the covenant of brotherhood that Amos mentioned. It's a reminder of the kindness that Esau had when his brother Jacob had returned after more than 14 years of serving Laban. However, the brotherhood waxed and it waned. Some Israelites had fled to Tyre for safety, but they were captured and they were sold to the Edomites as slaves. These descendants of Esau were unkind and cruel to Israel, as was previously noted. Edom had enormous hatred and deep resentment, and that continues to be reflected among most Arab nations today, particularly those found in Iran and the majority of Palestinians, and also others. And others of this race who now dwell in various locations around the world. God then turns toward some of these people called Edom. In verse 11, thus says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Edom, and for four I will not turn away its punishment. Because he pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity, his anger tore perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. But I will send a fire upon Teman, which shall devour the palaces of Bozrah. Esau's resentment may have faded for a time, but his descendants continued to despise the children of Israel. We are reminded of Moses leading the tribes in the wilderness, and he sent a message to the king of Edom asking for a safe passage through their territory. This was recorded in Numbers chapter 20, and it is worth reviewing. If you have a bookmark here, and let's go back to Numbers chapter 20. And we'll begin reading in verse 14. Now Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom, and the message was this, thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians afflicted us and our fathers. When we cried out to the Eternal, he heard our voice and sent the angel and brought us up out of Egypt. Now here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your border. Please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through fields or vineyards, nor will we drink water from wells. We will go along the king's highway, and we will not turn aside to the right or to the left until we have passed through your territory. Then Edom responded and said, you shall not pass through my land, lest I come out against you with the sword. So the children of Israel said to him, we will go by the highway, and if I or my livestock drink any of your water, then I will pay for it. Let me only pass through on foot, nothing more. Then he said, you shall not pass through. So Edom came out against them with many men and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory. So Israel turned away from him. This incensed and spiteful attitude continues to this day among most Arab people who are descended from the Edomites, who are the progeny of Ishmael. Let's go back to Amos. Amos had mentioned in chapter 1 and verse 12 that God would send a fire upon Teman, which will devour the palaces of Bozrah. Teman and Bozrah were chief areas of Edomia, which is the place of the Edomites. The destruction of these places occurred during the conquests of Nebuchadnezzar. And now God declares justice upon the Ammonites. In verses 13 through 15, thus says the Eternal, for three transgressions of the people of Ammon, and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they ripped open the women with child in Gilead that they might enlarge their territory. But I will kindle a fire in the wall of Rabbah, and it shall devour its palaces amid shouting in the day of battle, and a tempest in the day of a whirlwind. Their king shall go into captivity, he and his princes together, says the Eternal. Ammonites are descendants of Benami, who was a son of Lot. The primary god of the Ammonites was Molech. Solomon is recorded to have fallen away from the true God, and he built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And that's stated in 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 7. The worship of Molech is associated with child sacrifice that included burning the body of the slain. While we do not know exactly what the idol of Molech was fashioned to look like, the depictions over the last century or more have been the head of a bull and the body of a man with arms stretched out. They may be accurate descriptions, we're just not entirely sure. This depiction may have been most famously illustrated by a 1914 Italian silent movie where a ritual of burning children in sacrifice to Molech was portrayed on the screen in black and white. Shockingly, this monstrous idol has been celebrated in recent years. There was an image of Molech that was recreated several years ago, and it was put on display at the entrance of the Roman Colosseum in the year 2019. The display of this pagan god shocked many people, because having this evil symbol of paganism representing the murder of children set up to greet crowds at one of the most traveled tourist sites in the world, what is offensive? The press release about the Molech display said this. It said it's a reconstruction of the terrible deity Molech, and it will be stationed at the entrance to the Colosseum to welcome visitors to the exhibition. If you can imagine. Now, it must be known that the Vatican has ownership and authority over the Roman Colosseum, including authority over all its displays, its exhibits, and functions. And one of the critics of this display wrote this. There is no way that such a thing could be done without direct permission from the highest levels of the Vatican. If anyone wants to do anything there, at the Colosseum that is, they must get permission from the office of the Diocese of Rome. This exhibition could not be held there at all unless it was granted at high levels. The display was set up in November of 2019. It was scheduled to be removed March 19th in 2020, and I believe that that is when it was removed. However, not before it offended many people, who were unpleasantly surprised when visiting a site where many Christians were murdered in the name of gods like Molech, and then greeted now by a statue of one of the worst. God mentioned one of the brutal acts of Ammon was to cut open pregnant women when they attacked people. This is shocking cruelty. But the reason for it was more than just bloodlust. It was an attempt to not allow for the land to be taken back by its previous inhabitants. You see, they would try to leave little to no descendants who might one day rise up and try to take it back. And so they were killing even unborn children. Amos 1 and verse 14 says that God would kindle a fire in the wall of Rabbah, and its palatial estates would be devoured, along with the kings and the princes being removed. This undoubtedly came to pass, and in fact there are ruins of ancient Rabbah that still stand today, and we have some images of them. One of them is a fortress outside of the city that still goes by the name of Rabbah, and this is in Jordan. This is a testament to Ammon's heyday. There are also ruins within the inhabited areas of Rabba that are mostly Roman because this land and people were eventually conquered by the Roman Empire. And we have images of those as well. The time of the destruction of Ammon as a prominent people has been questioned. Some say it began with the Assyrian invasion, and it might have, but archaeological findings indicate that they maintained independence by paying Assyrian tribute. A list from that period shows that Ammon paid one-fifth as much as Judah, who also paid tribute in order to remain in control of their territory. It has also been thought that the rise of the Babylonian Empire saw the destruction of Ammon. This is partly corroborated by Josephus, who wrote in Antiquities of the Jews, Book 10, Chapter 9, and Verse 7, on the fifth year after the destruction of Jerusalem, which was the 23rd of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, he made an expedition against Celesyria, and when he had possessed himself of it, he made war against the Ammonites and Moabites. And when he had brought all these nations under subjection, he fell upon Egypt in order to overthrow it, and he slew the king that then reigned and set up another. And he took those Jews that were there captives and led them away to Babylon. And such was the end of the nation of the Hebrews. While the Ammonites were overcome more than once, archaeology indicates that Ammon continued during the period of the Neo-Babylonian Empire from 626 to 539 BC. There is some evidence suggesting that Ammon can even continue to the Persian period up to 330 BC. In the first book of Maccabees, the Ammonites and their neighboring tribes are noted for having resisted the revival of Judah under Judas Maccabeus in the period of 167 to 160 BC. However, this does not mean that they were a prominent people. They had been greatly reduced as a significant people or nation. The last mention of the Ammonites in ancient history occurs in Justin Martyr's dialogue with Trypho, where he said that there are still a great number of Ammonites when referring to their assimilation to the wider Arab community found in the descendants of Ishmael and Esau. There are still people of Ammon today in Jordan, and they remain to have a monarchy. Ezekiel 25. Even though the descendants of Ammon still exist in Jordan, some are likely scattered around the world. They were made very low. The prophet Ezekiel also foretold of this in Ezekiel 25, verses 1 through 7, where the word of the Eternal came to Ezekiel, saying, "Son of man, set your face against the Ammonites and prophesy against them. Say to the Ammonites, hear the word of the Eternal God. Thus says the Lord God, because you said, aha, against my sanctuary when it was profaned, and against the land of Israel when it was desolate, and against the house of Judah when they went into captivity." And this phrase, aha, it's an energetic expression of being pleased, like, yes, in your face. Indeed, verse 4, therefore I will deliver you as a possession to the men of the east, and they shall set their encampments among you, and make their dwellings among you. They shall eat your fruit, and they shall drink your milk. And I will make Rabbah a stable for camels, and Ammon a resting place for flocks. Then you shall know that I am the Eternal. For thus says the Lord God, because you clapped your hands, stamped your feet, and rejoiced in heart with all your disdain for the land of Israel, indeed, therefore, I will stretch out my hand against you and give you as plunder to the nations. I will cut you off from the peoples and will cause you to perish from the countries. I will destroy you, and you shall know that I am the Eternal. So these people rejoiced in the tragedies of Judah and Israel. They also had a part to play in the brutal cruelty and depravity. However, God's concern was not only about brutal, unnecessary treatment of Israel. he's concerned about other people as well. So before we conclude, I would like to move in a bit to chapter 2 of the book of Amos, because it's very much connected to chapter 1. Now, as we know, verse numbers and chapter breaks were added much later, and if it were up to me at this time, I would have included the first three verses of chapter 2 into chapter 1, because it continues to deal with yet another Gentile nation. Amos 2, and I'm going to read the first three verses. For three transgressions of Moab, and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because he burned the bones of the king of Edom to lime. But I will send a fire upon Moab, and it shall devour the palaces of Kerioth. Moab shall die with tumult, and with a shouting and trumpet sound. And I will cut off the judge from its midst, and slay all its princes with him, says the Eternal. Once again, we have the idiomatic phrase meaning that there were more than enough transgressions to justify God's judgment. The people of Moab are also descendants of the son of Lot, or a son of Lot. They became a well-known people who were considered pagan in a Gentile community. After Elijah was taken by God to be a prophet solely to the southern kingdom of Judah, his student Elisha became a prophet to the northern kingdom, the house of Israel. It was during that time that the king of Israel attempted to unite forces with Judah and Edom to attack Moab. And the account is found in 2 Kings chapter 3, and I'm not going to turn there. But Moab countered, and he did not prevail. And in fact, he had lost ground. When Israel destroyed cities and filled their springs of water, Israel also cut down trees so that Moab would have little left to rebuild with. 2 Kings 3 verse 26 says that the king of Moab then took 700 of his men and attacked Edom, but could not prevail against them. So he offered the eldest, the one who would have been the next in line to the throne, as a burnt offering, likely in honor of their chief god Molech. Some think that this human sacrifice was the event that Amos mentioned, and that the eldest son may have been the eldest son of the king of Edom. That might be possible, but not likely as I understand it. When and where that abhorrent event occurred is not documented, except for verse 1 of chapter 2 in Amos. Some ancient authors say that Moab not only burned the bones of a dignitary, but mixed the residue with plaster and used this plaster for walls of a palatial room. That certainly would be a detestable act, but it's something that cannot be verified. Jeremiah in chapter 48, if you will. Whatever occurred, it was something wicked, and the cruelty of Moab was against more than just Israel. This is not the only reason God declared a judgment on those people. Remember the idiom, for three and for four. The prophet Jeremiah gives more detail in describing God's judgment on Moab. In Jeremiah 48, we're going to read the first four verses. Against Moab, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, woe to Nebo, for it plundered Kirjathaim, is shamed and taken. The high stronghold is shamed and dismayed. No more praise of Moab. In Heshbon they have devised evil against her. Come and let us cut her off as a nation. You also shall be cut down, O madmen. The sword shall pursue you. A voice of crying shall be from Haranoim, plundering and great destruction. Moab is destroyed. Her little ones have caused a cry to be heard. If you'd go down several verses to verse 25. Make him drunk, because he exalted himself against the Eternal. Moab shall wallow in his vomit, and he shall be in derision. For was not Israel a derision to you? Was he found among thieves? For whenever you speak of him, you shake your head in scorn. So they were mocking Israel. They hated Israel. And when they spoke of Israel's calamity, it was like they laughed their heads off. The annihilation of Moab appears to be more thorough than some of the other nations, but this is just my opinion. The Moabites are kin to Ammon, and both of these Gentile tribes mixed with some of the Jews during the rebuilding of the Second Temple. God forbade that, saying, "You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves." The reason is the same as what led to Solomon and eventually all of Israel to sin in ways that would lead to national ruin. The two ancient tribes of Ammon and Moab are found in Jordan today. Sunni Islam is the dominant religion, where Muslims make up about 96% of the country's population. Islam, in any shape or form, is a wicked religion, and it's declared by God that such populations will be decimated before Christ returns. This first chapter of Amos, along with the next chapter, is a lesson for all nations. We see God punishing people for their unnecessary abuse of other human beings. Yes, he has allowed conflict to teach people a lesson, but God never inspires excessive force, abuse, or cruelty in the conflict. God has brought such nations down for their inhumane treatment of others, and he will do it again. In Zephaniah, in chapter 2, God would punish Syria and Assyria because they were wicked and cruel. He would punish the Philistines because they murdered and bought and sold human beings who were abused. The Phoenicians traded in human lives and forsook the brotherhood that they had with other nations. The Moabites were violent and vindictive. The Edomites were unforgiving and took revenge. And God brought them down, and he will do such things again. God will eventually destroy the brutal regimes of Iran, of North Korea, of China, and others. They will pay for their continuous cruelty, even upon their own people. God will bring down the idolatry of India, of Brazil, and other nations. America, Canada, and all the Western European nations will be brought low because of their increasingly evil behavior. Amos gets to that in the next chapters. God is not a respecter of persons, and what is good for the goose is good for the gander. Romans 2 and verse 12, "For as many as have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and as many as have sinned in the law will be judged by the law." This is what will happen when people are wicked, not just by being disrespectful toward God, but being cruel to their fellow man. Another prophet who spoke of God's justice upon the nations is Zephaniah. Zephaniah in chapter 2. "Gather yourselves together. Yes, gather together, O undesirable nation, before the decree is issued, or the day passes like chaff, before the Eternal's fierce anger comes upon you, before the day of the Eternal's anger comes upon you, seek the Eternal. All you meek of the earth who have upheld his justice, seek righteousness, seek humility. It may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Eternal's anger." And then he goes on with this judgment. "For Gaza shall be forsaken and Ashkelon desolate. They shall drive out Ashdod at noonday, and Ekron shall be uprooted. Woe to the inhabitants of the sea coast, the nation of the Kerethites. The word of the Eternal is against you. O Canaan, land of the Philistines, I will destroy you, so there shall be no inhabitant." Jumping down to verse 8, "And I have heard of the reproach of Moab, and the insults of the people of Ammon, which they have reproached my people, and made arrogant threats against their borders. Therefore, as I live, says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be like Sodom, and the people of Ammon like Gomorrah, overrun with weeds and salt pits, and a perpetual desolation. The residue of my people shall plunder them, and the remnant of my people shall possess them." And then if you jump down to verse 12, You Ethiopians also, you shall be slain by my sword, and he will stretch out his hand against the north, destroy Assyria, and make Nineveh a desolation. This had already been done, but there's a duality in this. There will be a complete fulfillment of this prophecy. The herd shall lie down in her midst, and every beast of the nation, both the pelican and the bittern, shall lodge in the capitals of her pillars. And so he'll make it a fruitful land in the future. These are prophecies that included things that came to pass, but they include things that are going to come. They include hundreds of millions of people, but there's a lesson from each of them for us. Understand that you and I have a responsibility to treat people fairly and with respect. Now, this is easy to do when somebody likes us. But what about strangers? What about those people who do not like us? How do we treat them? Are we kind to those people? Or do we seek to hurt them? Give them the cold shoulder even? When reviled, do we return the insult? 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 12 says, being reviled we should bless, and being persecuted we endure. And the Apostle Peter wrote in 1 Peter 2 and verse 23 that deceit will not be found in the mouth of those people that are faithful to God. When he's reviled, we won't revile in return. He's speaking about Christ, but it's the way that you and I are to be. Because when he suffered, he did not threaten, but he committed himself to him who judges righteously. So justice will come, but it's not up to us to be the vigilante. Whether at work or at school, in the marketplace or on the internet, we should be kind to people. We might be the people who are the apple of God's eye, but he is not going to overlook uncalled for or ill treatment of others, no matter who we might be. In fact, you and I are to be held to a higher standard. And so let's read a little bit of Luke 12 to end. Luke 12, notice the conclusion of a parable regarding the need to learn how to be faithful to God in every respect. Luke 12 and verse 42. And the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all that he has. So doing is a general phrase, and it encompasses a lot of things, including being kind, including not seeking revenge, including being fair and honest in everything and to everyone. In verse 47, and that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know yet committed things deserving of stripes shall be beaten with a few. In other words, God's not going to let any of it pass, but to those people who know better, it's going to be worse off if we don't do what we should. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required, and to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask more. So there is a lot required of us, and God is not going to let ill treatment of other people slide just because we claim to be Christian. In fact, more is expected of those people who are called. This first chapter of Amos, proceeding into the second, is a reminder of the kind of people that you and I are to be. Yeah, we might not be violent, but how do we speak to people? How do we treat them? Do we intentionally rub people the wrong way? Do we instigate anger? Are we angry ourselves? No, we are not to be like this. We are to be people who are strong and humble and faithful, unbending in God's way. We are to be sensitive and yet malleable in the seat of our emotions. Don't let anger and resentment get the best of us. Be kind, be meek, because, as Christ said, it is the meek who shall inherit the earth.